You ever get that feeling that there's just too much? There's just too much of something that you're feeling weight, that something's pushing you down? I was feeling that recently. I was feeling this weight, which, to be honest, is not an uncommon thing for me because the autistic brain is kind of geared more towards overwhelm, overload. It's one of the key attributes of autism. So oftentimes I face executive disruption where just my executive function is not on par with where it is. But what I've been discovering in recent years is that sleep is a big part of that. So if I can consistently get good sleep, when I do go through periods of executive disruption, they don't completely disrail my life like they have in the past. But this time, this overwhelm that I was feeling wasn't coming from things I needed to do, things I hadn't done. You know, like if I don't keep my room tidy, keep my rooms tidy, and I just let things build up and I try to ignore it, that will derail me because it's this overwhelming sensation of something in the back of my head just kind of tapping on my skull like, hey, messy. It's messy in here, messy. So generally, I keep things pretty clear just to, you know, save my brain somewhat. But when it comes to tasks and notes and, you know, all of the digital crap that any of us deal with on a regular basis, accounts and passwords and all of this, at a certain point, that stuff can overwhelm me. But this time, I wasn't feeling it from that. I wasn't feeling it from that at all. I thought everything was going smoothly. And it took me actually just kind of sitting. I remember exactly when it happened. I was watching television. And I just had this lingering feeling like, I got to figure out what this feeling is. I have to figure out what this feeling is. I don't know if you do this. Like, you have this feeling that there's something going on in your mind, but you're crowding it out. You're staying busy. You're pushing it off. It's not going anywhere. You're just pushing it in the corner, but it's still sitting there and it's still there. And you know eventually you have to stop and recognize it and see what it is, see what it is saying, what's this message in your mind. And actually, you know what I'm going to do right now while I'm sitting here? Let's go into airplane mode. Speaking of overwhelm. So I was watching TV. I paused it and I just sat there for a minute. I was like, okay, fine. What is it? And I don't even know. This is the first time I've tried to put this into words. What happened? There's nothing mystical, but just this moment of relief. And I connected for the first time that sense of relief that I felt with the pausing of the television. And I had to explore that. Obviously, it didn't come to me all in a second. I had to think about, well, why is pausing the TV giving me some sort of relief? And I realized it wasn't just television, it was everything, every form of input. When I thought about putting things into my brain, music, television, movies, books, podcasts, videos, social media, news, anything you can think of that you pump into your brain, that we pump into our brains every day, blogs, magazine articles. Every time I thought of one of those things, I felt that weight. And let me focus on one in particular. Let's talk about podcasts, because I think podcasts, for me, are a really good exemplification of what I'm talking about here. The weight from podcasts comes from keeping up with it. I mean, you might feel the same thing with your social media feed. I don't know about you, but until I don't know, probably 5 years ago when I quit social media and then came back. Up until that point, I was always a completionist. What I mean is, for example, X, which at the time was Twitter, I would always go back to the last tweet that I read and then read everything, read the whole thing. I would read the complete timeline. You know, now I follow hundreds of people, but back then I probably only followed 50 or 60 people. Not a lot if they're only tweeting once a day. But you know that doesn't happen. So I was reading all of this stuff. All of this stuff was going into my head. And then at the whole time in the back of my head was this worry of like, hurry up, let's get to the present. Let's get to the present, you know, this rushing feeling. And then if I was away from it for too long, I would feel this like, oh man, when I go back, there's going to be so much to read. And that's the same thing that would happen and does happen to me with podcasts. There are so many podcasts that I think are interesting that I want to watch, that I want to listen to. Same could be said for YouTube. I think that's why the word watch popped up there. So many things that I want to watch and listen to that I'll end up subscribing to a bunch of stuff. And then what ends up happening is the backlog to get to the present is so full that I start to feel the weight of being behind. You know, for example, one of the podcasts I follow, a lot of people do, is Joe Rogan. He will put out sometimes 4, maybe even 5 episodes in a week, and they're typically 2 to 3 hours. So do the math there. You have to invest a certain amount of time into your day each day just to keep up with episodes of one podcast. Then if you follow something else like Tim Ferriss, which is usually like 1.5 hours, and then typically seems to be about 2 episodes a week, starts to really add up. But even if you're just following a bunch of little ones that only do, you know, like 30, 40 minute episodes a week, you know, 5 or 6 of those once a week is still a lot. You know, you can manage one of those a day, maybe. But if it goes above that, you're starting to do what I was doing, was is trying to actually make time in my day to, I want to say binge, but almost binge podcasts. And add on top of that television, add on top of that that I'm reading all the time, add on top of that social media, add on top of that wanting to find time to listen to music. And that was the feeling that I was feeling, this burden. So I took a week off. I said, you know what? I don't care if I get behind on the podcast. I'm not going to look. I'm not going to open my social media for a week. I'm not going to, what else didn't I do? I listened to music, but I would only listen to, I went in my library and I listened to music on a record so that I wasn't looking at any app. Because even though there's not really a feeling of behind when it comes to music, I use Spotify for my music and my podcast. So if I were to open up Spotify for music that week, it would automatically remind me of all the podcasts that I'm not watching. And my big worry was I was going to see something I wanted to watch or listen to, you know, an interview. I think I keep going back and forth between the word listen and watch because in particular, like Joe Rogan in Spotify is video and audio. So sometimes I watch it, sometimes I don't. But I was afraid if I opened that app that, you know, maybe, for example, he would do an interview, or Tim would do an interview with somebody. I'm like, that's something I really want to listen to. And even if I didn't listen to that in the moment, I knew that I would have it in my head for the rest of the week. Like, I can't wait to get to that. Which anticipation could be a good thing, but when it feels like pressure, it's different. Get some water here. Tea, really. So Like I said, I've only listened to music. Actually, typically what I ended up doing with music is I didn't even listen to a whole record. I would just listen to one side. And that was kind of enough. One side, like once, maybe, I didn't listen, not every day, but maybe like three or four times during that week. TV, I limited myself down to like 2 hours, which when you say it like that, sounds like a lot. But then when you actually do the math on how much television most people watch, 2 hours is not even a drop in the bucket. I think last time I saw, the average person watches 6 to 8 hours of television a day. I didn't end up watching any movies, although I could have. You know, there was no rules here. It was just kind of like, how much of this can I just push out? My whole point was to really allow most of my day for... This is something Cal Newport talks about in his book, Digital Minimalism. He talks about the idea of a digital detox. And he uses the term digital detox in specific because when we think about changing our relationship with, I don't want to say the digital world because it's not just the digital world, but with inputs, whatever we're inputting. When we think about that, often we think about it kind of like the way that people who smoke think about quitting smoking. I think of it like that, at least because I was, 10 years ago, I was a smoker. And I say it like that because I quit smoking. But we don't think of cold turkey when we quit smoking. We think of, well, you know, normally I smoke 10 cigarettes a day. What if I just, you know, smoke 5? And then if I can do just 5, then I'll go down to 4, then I'll go down to 3. We think of this gradation thing. And I think when it comes to inputs, we do the same thing. You know, like I said, I didn't go to 0 either, but during the day, I actually did. We'll get into that more. I want to clarify that before I get too confusing here. But when we think of input reduction, we think of, well, I'll just listen to the last podcast. We don't even get specific often. Well, I'll just listen to the last podcast. I'll watch a little less TV. Let's just stick with those two right now. Maybe I'll just, you know, read an article here or there. I won't read Twitter too much. I'll just open it up in the morning and maybe in the afternoon. And what Cal Newport says is you are never going to redefine your relationship with those things as long as you maintain a relationship with those things. That's not his exact wording. He doesn't use that type of wording at all, but that's what he means. And let me actually explain this in the context of how this occurred to me, because I think it's a better order. My goal was to have the majority of my day free from all input. Obviously, human beings and stuff like that, you can't avoid, like life, but no television, no movies, no podcasts, no music, only books during the day. And I was reading paper books for the week. Just once again, to avoid that relationship with the screen. And I purposely made sure that, number one, like when I did watch TV, like I said, or listen to an album, that was at the end of the day, so that I had gone 10, 11 hours without this stuff, because I was trying to reset my relationship. Lost my train of thought there with what I was saying, but the realization immediately comes that you're bored. At least for me, I'm in this continual state of I need to feel like I'm doing something. I need to have an activity. I need to have a project. I need to be doing something. Even when I watch TV, I'm usually, I have my laptop in front of me. I'm doing something. I'm copying notes. I'm moving things around. I'm organizing things. I'm always doing something. So the thing that when I said I lost my train of thought, what I was going to say is I purposely avoided allowing myself to read more than a couple hours per day. And the reason for that was I was afraid that this desire for podcasts and movies and television, anything else that would fill my day, I would just be pushing that off onto books. So I wouldn't be really reestablishing a relationship. I would just, you know, be taking this addiction feeling and channeling it into books. Oh, I'll just read. You know what? I'll read 7 books this week. That's still an information overload. So I limited my book reading to avoid that, because what I really wanted was large chunks of the day where I was completely bored, where I was sitting and I was literally doing nothing. And it's torture. And I did it on purpose because I think that the addiction that we have is not with digital. You know, we talk about digital addiction to devices. We talk about social media addiction. We talk about TV addiction. It's just activity addiction. There's so much available to us that we can be busy at every moment of the day. And being bored or being inactive, which I've discovered are 2 different things, can be so torturous that we choose all the time to keep ourselves active. And it starts to fry our brain. We have this thing called the default network, which our brain is supposed to kick into the default network when we're not in an activity. And the default network, among other things, as I understand it, manages our social relationships in our mind. This is why a lot of times if you're bored, you end up having conversations with other people in your head. Often I end up doing interviews in my head. Why? But the default network, as per the name, is the default state for the brain. To some degree, this is what Daniel Kahneman talks about in Fast Thinking and Slow Thinking. A little bit different, but he's talking about the 2 modes of thinking. You have the fast and the slow. The fast is, let's not even go into that. It's also something that Jonathan Haidt talks about, except he refers to it as the elephant and the rider. Each of them have different connotations about what it means, but in essence, what they're talking about is the difference between the default state and the active state. Not 100% accurate, but generally accurate for what we're saying. You know, like, for example, I think Jonathan Haidt's thing about the elephant and the rider, sometimes it, to some degree, incorporates a lot more emotion and instinct than System 1, System 2, or what I'm talking about do. So they have their nuances. It's not exactly a blanket statement, but it works for what we're talking about here. When we're not in the default state, we're in an active state. I haven't read anything about this in particular, but knowing about the default state, I have to wonder what happens to the human brain if we never allow it to go into the default state. The not inactive, but the less active state. You know, the mind never really turns off. Anybody that's tried meditation knows that your mind doesn't really turn off. You just have to learn how to direct it into less active activities, like paying attention to your breath as opposed to spinning off on some drama in your head. So I imagine that not going into the default state would begin to do something to our psyche, which is part of, I think, Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff's argument in Coddling of the American Mind, that the effects of social media and the internet are why we're starting to see an influx of mental health problems, in particular among college students. Lack of default network. So I think what I've been trying to, I guess that's how I've been trying to understand what I went through over the last week. And when I said I learned the difference between inactive and bored, I guess the difference really has to do with how you feel about being inactive. Another example of meditation again. You can have a really difficult meditation session. It's torturous. Maybe your body is uncomfortable or your mind just won't stop coming up with thoughts and you just start to judge yourself. I suck at this. And then times you can have this like blissful experience with meditation where like you've let air out finally that you've been holding in for so long. And I think that is the difference in similarity is the difference between boredom and inactivity. That boredom is when you're inactive and it's driving you crazy. Inactivity is when you're inactive and you're enjoying it. You know, maybe you're in Cancun, laying in the sun, sipping on a Mai Tai with a hat over your eyes. Inactive, but not bored. You're doing exactly what you want to be doing in that moment. And I think for so long, I've associated any inactivity not only with boredom, but also it's been attached to my self-esteem. What I mean by that is when I feel like I'm not doing something, I feel like I'm being lazy, I feel like I'm being a loser. So I've had this perpetual motion inside of me to keep doing and keep doing and keep doing. And a lot of that doing involves consumption because I don't know if this is how accurate this is either, but I have this mechanism in my head, this thought mechanism in my head that tells me the more you consume, the more you learn, the more you learn, the better you'll be able to actually make things, the better you'll be able to actually do things. To some degree, that's true. You know, especially when I think about some of the things I want to do, like write books. I need to read in order to write books. I need to learn some things. I can't just spout nonsense and then publish it and expect people to read it. I need to understand what I'm talking about. I need to just understand how other people see the things that I'm talking about. So I've associated that consumption with doing something and with my self-esteem. So going back to digital detox, the reason you have to detox as opposed to dial down is because as long as you're getting, we'll go back to the cigarettes, as long as you're still getting nicotine in your system, you're not resetting your relationship with cigarettes. Because even one cigarette a day is keeping enough nicotine in your system to keep you in the addictive state. So you're still in a chemical-dependent relationship with nicotine, even if you reduce how many cigarettes you're having every day. So if you really want to reset your relationship with cigarettes, you have to go through enough time that all of the nicotine passes out of your system, which I think ends up being about, I think it's about 2 weeks before it really flushes everything out from what I remember. And then you're just, then what you're dealing with as far as quitting cigarettes, then you begin to deal with mental addiction, mental habits. Ooh, usually I have a cigarette after I eat. Oh, I don't smoke anymore. Ooh, I'm drinking and I usually smoke when I'm drinking. These aren't physical cravings. These are mental addictions. But to get over the physical, you know, everybody, I think, manifests different. Some people get nervous without it. Some people get fidgety. Some people get hungry. Some people get angry. You got to get all of that out of your system so you can get out of that before you can even start to deal with the mental stuff. In the same way with digital is, I'm avoiding digital here, I forgot, with input. As long as you're pumping stuff into your head, you can't get into a state of your of mind where you can actually look at things from kind of a blank slate. You know, you want to come from a neutral place. If you're going to judge your relationship with these things, that's the purpose of the digital detox, is to get to a place where you can see what you actually need and how you want to use it. You know, the point of the digital detox with Cal Newport, for example, we'll say X or Twitter, The purpose is not to say I will never use Twitter again after I do this. That's why it's different than cigarettes. But the purpose is to get to a place where that addiction to it is out of your head and you can look at it and go, okay, do I want to use this? Does this particular thing bring any benefit to me in a positive way? And you want to be from a clear-headed point of view. You don't want to still be in the addiction of it, because the addiction of it is always going to tell you, yes, 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 must have, my precious. But if you can get away from that, you can look at it and you go, okay, you know, yeah, there's still advantages to it because I connect with people. And then, like, we'll use me for an example. The more interesting relationships I create, the more interesting things that I have available to me, the more interesting people I have available to me, or the if I ignore posting completely, then my videos won't do as well. So there's all these like little things, right? So you have to look at all those and go, okay, well, what does that mean? And since you're in a clear-headed place, you can say, well, that means I should post on a regular basis so that people think I'm not gone, but I don't need to post like 6-7 times a day, because that's hard, because when I go into posts and end up reading too much and then stuff like that. So you start to be able to look at the relationship from a different place because you're in a clear-headed spot, because you've been detoxified from it. Same with television, same with even with reading. All of these things, you need to pull yourself out of. So that's what I was doing this week. And you know, one of the interesting things, not to go off on too much of a tangent here, what I found myself doing was thinking about the past a lot, which for me usually has not been common. You know, I have like a flicker of something from the past. Oh, that reminds me of something, but never really dwelling on moments from the past. And I found myself doing that more and more. And what I started to do while I was dwelling on the past more and more, and I don't mean dwelling in a negative sense, but I mean just like dwelling, like I'm living in that memory for a little bit, dwelling it, you know, sitting on the couch of my old living room for a few moments. What I started to happen was I started to have more detail of my memories. And I started to understand my memories more in context of now. Now, I don't want to make this sound like something dramatic, like I had some life-changing experience here. We're only talking about a little bit, but I imagine the more space you create, the more of a relationship you could have with your past, because I think that past, that dwelling on the past, is also something that happens in the default network. Because we're re-examining our relationships from the past. This is part of the human thing of learning and adapting. So I started to wonder, I'm like, how many memories are just like trapped in stasis because I've never taken the time, have time, to allow them to process. You know, they've been sitting in a buffer for decades. So that's what I did for the last week, was try to clear that out. What I also discovered was that one of my problems, one of my bigger problems, wasn't just media, but new media. And I don't mean new media in the sense of like social media is new media and TV is old media. I mean like new media as in stuff that's being made now. New movies, new books, new, you know, podcasts about current affairs, news, new TV shows. The more I watched or interacted with things about the past or from the past, and the less I engaged with stuff being made now, the more that also contributed to relief of that pressure. So it wasn't just the pressure of not going into my default network. I also think there's something to be said about new media or current media, maybe a better way to say it. Current media comes with an inherent pressure. Current media comes with the inherent pressure of having to make judgments about the present. When you watch a TV show, and as most TV shows do now, they try to tell you what you should think and feel, you can't just enjoy the show, because now you have to battle this message that's being pushed on you. Do I agree with it? Don't I agree with it? And that makes it less enjoyable. There's something to be said about some of your media being escapism. And what you're escaping is not reality. What you're escaping is the pressures of the present moment. Sometimes you need to escape the fact that Ukraine and Russia are at war. Sometimes you need to escape the fact that Israel and Gaza and Hamas are at war. Sometimes you need to escape the fact that the U.S. is bombing the Houthis. Sometimes you need to escape the trans issues. Sometimes you need to escape DEI. Sometimes you need to escape thinking about Wall Street. Sometimes you need to just walk away from thinking about the economy or the election. Sometimes you just need to not think about those things for a few minutes. Not saying ignore the world and disappear from it, but sometimes you need to turn those off and just be you for a little while. And the only way I found that I could do that with media is to watch things from the past. Because when I watch a TV show from the 80s and Ronald Reagan comes up, guess what? I don't have to think or feel anything. Bill Clinton comes up, guess what? I don't have to think or feel anything. The Berlin Wall comes up, I don't have to think or feel anything. Vietnam comes up, I don't have to think or feel anything. I can just engage. Because for all intent and purposes, it's like watching a period drama, you know? It's like watching something, a movie made about 1700s. I'm not engaged with the 1700s because I didn't live through them. I'm not emotionally attached to them the way that I am the present. So when you watch older media, listen to older media, you can still let go. So that's a way to reduce without having to reduce completely. And to be honest, I'll be honest, most movies and TV shows now suck. They suck hard, really hard. They look fake. The acting is okay, but the writing is terrible. It's like everybody's on the pulpit preaching and nobody's worried about telling a good story anymore, and I just can't stomach it. I put something on and I'm like, oh, this looks cool, and I want to get lost in the story, and all of a sudden, they're pulling me to the present. They're pulling me out of that suspension of disbelief that something should give you, that you can let go of that world and get immersed in this fictional world, even if the fictional world looks just like yours, you know, like if it's a cop show or something like that. But then all of a sudden, some issues come up, something about the present, and it pulls you out of that and back into the state of, oh, there's so many things I have to think about, so many moral and ethical decisions I need to make right this moment. It's too much. It's too much for all the time. So I've given up on modern movies. I don't care about the MCU anymore. I'm not watching any of the Star Wars stuff. I don't care about any of it. Something came up the other day. They were talking about, I don't know if it's the Golden Globes or the Academy Awards. I don't know if anybody watches that crap anymore anyways. But there was like a list of movies, and I had only heard of one of them, and that was Oppenheimer. The only reason I've heard of Oppenheimer is because I know who Oppenheimer was. I know what Oppenheimer did. I know his quote of the Rig Veda when the bomb went off, I have become death. I didn't know what any of the other ones are, and you know what? I don't care. Maybe in 10 years when they're old, I'll watch them. But I'm going back and watching stuff from the 80s, stuff from the 90s, and some stuff from the early 2000s, some of it's good. Stuff from the 70s, old TV shows. That's where I'm living. Not because I'm hiding from the present, but because when I sit down to be entertained, I want to be entertained. I don't want to be educated. And when I sit down to be educated, I want to be educated. So because of that, books are my main form of education. So when I want to be educated, I will read a book. If I want to be educated about race, I will read a book about race. If I want to be educated about civil rights, I will read a book about civil rights. If I want to be educated about the Austrian School of Economy, I will read a book about the Austrian School of Economy. I don't need a movie or a TV show to tell me about it in a crappily written 5-minute segment squeezed into a show. No, I don't need that. So here's the funny thing. I don't know if you've ever heard of this phrase. I had another phrase for it before. It's long gone from my head after I heard this phrase, shelf fairy. So the shelf fairy is this idea of, it's hard to explain. The idea that you randomly decide to grab a book and the thing that you read in that book happens to be the exact thing that you need to read in that moment. Synchronicity, obviously it's like shelf fairy is like a subdivision of synchronicity. I have a long storied history with synchronicities. They happen to me all the time. Sometimes hard to deny ones, hard to deny that something abnormal is going on. We can go into that some other time. But the shelf fairy is, like I said, you pick up a book and you just happen to pick up this book and you start reading and you're like, whoa. So this book here, when I was in my 20s, which was 25 years ago, I had this idea. I grew up with a mom who used to like to read Bible passages every day. And because of that, I was aware of something called a devotional. A devotional being, it's a book written for you to open and read one page per day. There's usually a Bible passage and then something about, you know, some sort of interpretation of that Bible passage. You've seen this done more recently with like Ryan Holiday with the Daily Stoic, except not with Bible verses, with Stoicism. And then somebody did one, I think it's Ryan Holiday too, the Daily Dad. I think that's kind of a similar thing, right? Obviously not being a dad, I haven't read or watched or listened to. I don't know what kind of media it is. But I had this idea in my 20s before all of that, of what if there was something non-religious as a devotional, nothing to take away or against, you know, against religion, but just like, what if you were every day you read a page and it was something for your brain instead of your spirit? And, you know, I didn't have a name for it. I was like, yeah, be cool. And of course, as many ideas you have when you're younger, nothing happens. And then years later, I'm in a Barnes & Noble and I see this on the shelf. Now, if you're just listening, I'm holding up a book, and the title of the book is The Intellectual Devotional, 365 Daily Lessons from the Seven Fields of Knowledge. This is the idea I had. So, of course, I bought it because, you know, I didn't bring it into the world, but somebody did, and they should get my money. Felt like they should have my money. And I've had this book for a long time. Let's see what year it was published. Then we'll have a general idea, at least. So 2006. Yeah, 2006 this was published. So I probably bought it around then. So this has been kicking around for a long time. Now, there's a bookmark here, and the bookmark is on page... Wow, that is a really hard-to-read number. Oh, it's not a number, it's a symbol. Okay, 104. So as you can tell, I've been going through this book very slowly. I've never consistently read this book every day. And in fact, before I moved to Texas, I can remember the last time I was reading this on a semi-regular basis was back when I was in California. And it must have been, you know, a couple weeks I went through. So I went through, you know, about 20 pages of it consistently. And then that was probably the last time that I read it. And in fact, if I look, Handel's Messiah, actually, yes, the last time I read it was in California because I remember specifically reading this page on Handel's Messiah. So I left that bookmark in the book. It's built into the book. And when I packed up all my stuff, I moved to Texas. This was one of my books. When I got here and I started unpacking everything, I started putting stuff into my bathroom. This is a great bathroom book. When I say I remember reading Handel's Messiah, it's because I read it in the bathroom. It's one page. So, you know, you sit down, read a page, put the book back. There's no continuing story. It's perfect for that kind of format. There's also these bathroom books that have trivia. So I have some of those in the bathroom. So I have like three or four of books that I think are appropriate for the bathroom in the bathroom. I don't read them that often, but they're there. You know, it's probably because most of the time, like you, I probably bust out my phone most of the time. So in the almost 3 years I've been in Texas, I had not opened this book once. And I was in this detox that we were just talking about, and I went into the bathroom and I didn't have my phone with me. In fact, I think this happened on the first day. My phone was on the cradle in my bedroom, and I never took it off that. It stayed there all day. I never took it off the cradle. I just let it sit there all day. So I was in the bathroom, and I decided, oh, you know what? I'll read something. There's some magazines in there, too. For some reason, I decided to open the Intellectual Devotional for the first time in 3 years. And I told you 104, because page 103 is Handel's Messiah. So I open up 104, René Descartes. Okay, yeah, let's read about René Descartes. And this is where the shelf fairy thing comes in. Like I said, I haven't picked up the book in 3 years. The day I decided to pick it up is the day that I decided that I need time alone with my thoughts. I need time alone with myself. I read it about Descartes, and then here are these two sentences. His most important work, arguably, was his Meditations on First Philosophy, 1641. The book recounted his thoughts over 6 days spent in a small room during his travels. And to me, that was just like, oh, punch right in the gut. His most famous work was written recounting his thoughts spent in a small room, obviously by himself, with no TV, with no radio, because it's 1641. He was able to accomplish this great work because of spending time alone for 6 days. And here I was planning to spend a week, 7 days, alone with my thoughts as much as possible. So this is a beautiful shelf fairy moment. So what I've come around to is less podcasts, more books. Now, once again, I'm still limiting myself on how much I read. I'm still trying to make space in the day to be alone, but I do enjoy podcasts, but I really try most days to not listen to more than one podcast a day. And generally when I do that, I walk the dog twice a day. When I walk him in midday after I have lunch, that's when I listen to that podcast. And if it's a longer one and I haven't finished it when I come back, then I'll sit and I'll finish listening to it. I also listen at 1.8 times speed, almost 2 point speed. So, you know, like I said, Joe Rogan episode, 3 hours. I'm not losing 3 hours on my day, just about an hour and a half. Which is not losing it. Also, you know, I should probably word it that way. But for me, podcasts, the problem is that podcasts, even though they can be very informative, they can be very educational, I don't consume them that way. I want to think of them that way, but that's my problem. The way that I consume podcasts is the way that TV commercials convince you that you consume Pringles. You can't have just one, right? I can't just sit down and consume one podcast and then pull myself back without having to exert some sort of self-control. I will consume and consume until there's nothing left. Either I run out of time or I run out of podcast. And I'll go back in the archive and listen to old episodes I haven't listened to if there's nothing new to listen to. So while I want to think of it as this thing that I can consume actively, what ends up happening is I always slip into a more passive. It's more enjoyable. So when I do try to listen to podcasts more actively and I try to sit notes while I listen to it, I don't enjoy it. So then I'll end up watching TV. I'm always going to find that thing that allows me to do what I really think that this part of my brain wants me to do, which is lay on the couch all day and eat Oreos. And I don't want to lay on the couch all day. And I don't want to eat Oreos. I mean, Oreos are delicious, but like, I don't eat sugar, processed sugar. No, I don't want that. So if I'm going to listen passively to something, then I might as well do it while I'm doing something else, which is why I listen to that one podcast a day while I'm walking. I'm already walking. It's fine with me. It's passive. I can't take notes here anyways. So whatever I listen to when I'm walking is going to be passive because I'm walking. I'm walking here. So that's how I'm dealing with that. Whereas reading, when I read, the more I sit with the book and I have something to take notes with, and the more I highlight and take notes and record my thoughts while I'm reading, the more engaged I am with that book. And the more I enjoy that. So there's that weird dichotomy there, because I understand that when I'm engaging with a book, I'm doing it because I'm wanting to learn something. Whereas my brain clicks into entertain me mode when I listen to podcasts. So I can't indulge the podcast as much. And generally when I read, I read 2 to 3 books a day. Hold on. There's no other way to say that doesn't sound crazy. I don't mean I finish 2 to 3 books a day. I mean that I pick up 2 to 3 books and I read passages from 2 to 3 books per day. Why? Okay, this isn't something I've done forever, but this is the reason that I do it right now. One of the other things I discovered in the week was my reading had become purposeless, other than general education. I was picking up books, I was reading them, and I was just, oh, that's interesting, which there's a word for that. It's called trivial. And it's called trivial because you're engaging with it for trivia. Oh, that's an interesting point. It's a trivial point. It's not driven towards a purpose. And one of the things I was reminded of is something that I had journaled a long time ago. And unfortunately, as we often do, we come to these realizations when we journal and then we forget them. But this realization I had was that I need two kinds of goals in my life. I need short-term goals and I need long-term goals. I need short-term goals as in the thing that's going to get me through the day. Hey, it's going to give me a little charge, a little something to make me feel good that I accomplished something today. And then I need a long-term goal because it gives me a sense of the future, something that I'm working towards. And both of those are really important to my self-esteem and my sense of purpose. So while I've been very eager to start a long-term project, in particular a book, I want to write a nonfiction book, I hadn't really settled on an idea for a long-term book project. Because I had this idea in my head that, well, first I need to get all of the notes out of my notebooks into a digital app, and then I need to look at everything, and then from there, I'll be able to go, oh, this is what I should do a book on because I have so much on that topic. What I was really doing, I didn't realize, was I was being lazy. I was hoping that my past self, who had made all these notes, would make a decision for me on what book I should write. And a lot of this ideology is tied to the Zettelkasten ideology of what Nicholas Luhmann did was read books, make notes on cards, and then allow those notes to cluster. And then as they cluster, you get a bottom-up idea of a book. Oh, I have all this stuff. But that was an inaccurate, and I knew it was inaccurate, but I was allowing this inaccurate idea of what Nicholas Luhmann did to invade my mind, because Nicholas Luhmann didn't read trivially. every time he picked up a book and read it, he was reading it towards a purpose. What formulations he made of those books and the arguments that he made came bottom up from the notes, but the project, the book or the article he's working on, was top down. I'm going to write a book about economic disparity in the middle class, Germany, 1922 to 1925. Okay, if he's going to do that, he has to read a whole bunch of books that are going to tell him about that. He's picked a topic. He hasn't picked an argument for the book. So he's picked a topic. The argument is going to come from the notes. The story, the narrative is going to come from the notes. The topic comes top down. Topic. Topic. So I was being lazy by not picking a topic. And the reason I say I was being lazy is because I knew what my first topic was going to be. And I was avoiding it because it's intimidating. And I'm not qualified to write a book on this topic. But that's exactly why I should write it. Because if I read enough books on it, then I can become qualified enough to write the book on it. That's the whole purpose. So I came to this realization. I said, okay, well, that means that if I'm going to get the satisfaction of a long-term goal, I have to continually work towards that long-term goal. And I just happened at the time to have seen, the week before I stopped watching video and stuff, I had happened to watch an old video of Ryan Holiday's where he's talking about writing books with his note cards. And one of the things he's talking about is he had to go on this book tour. I think it was for his, we'll just say he did a trilogy of books, Courage and I don't remember the other two, to be honest, sorry. But they were the virtues, cardinal virtues, I think. And Courage was the third one, if I remember correctly. He was still writing that one, but he had to do a publicity tour for like 2 weeks on the book that was already published, the one before, number two in the trilogy. So he had to walk away from writing the book, the new book, the current book, for 2 weeks to promote the previous book. And in particular for him, a lot of his work involves physical note cards and his boxes of cards that he can't take all of that with him on his two-week tour. He took his family with him. But he talked about just grabbing a stack of some of those cards and taking them with him. And he said all he tried to do on that trip was, as long as I do one little thing every day for the current book that I'm working on, I don't feel like I'm derailed. If I just do one little thing. And that's what I'm trying to do with this long-term project. You know, because first of all, the other thing I had to accept, I forgot to say this. It's intimidating, the subject matter I picked. But it doesn't mean I have to stick with it forever. I can try. And it's okay to not be able to do it. It's okay to get to a certain point and be like, you know what, I need to switch to another topic. I'm just not the writer who can write this. But I still need that attempt. I still need to learn all the lessons that I'm going to learn during that. So my goal is to always make one little step forward. Obviously, I want to do as much as I can every day for it. But as long as I do one small thing every day, never miss a day doing something for it, then I'm going to slowly march towards that finish line. So when I say 2 to 3 books a day, the first book a day, I'm going and I'm sitting right where I am now in front of my computer, sitting at my desk right here. In fact, I just finished doing this right before I turned on this recording for the video. And I read I generally read right now the book I'm reading for chapters or longer chapters. But I try to read at least an hour every morning at the computer, books related specifically to my long-term project, research books. That's the reason I'm doing it at the computer, is so that I can actually highlight a passage. Every time I highlight a passage, I need to type out what I'm thinking. And I need to type it in the moment. And that's the way I want to deal with it, because when I sit here, I know I mean business. This in front of the computer associates the project to me. This is an associative space for me. I actually don't like reading on the computer. I don't find it as pleasant. But because of that, it forces me to pay attention more. I can't drift off as much as I could if I was relaxing somewhere. Second book of the day, that I said 2 to 3 books a day. I always do that one every day. One of these other two I will usually do. I try to do all three, but I don't always. The second one is I read another nonfiction book, but then I just read that for triviality. Just a book that I want to read for pleasure. I want to pick this up. Could be a book about Teddy Roosevelt. Could be a book about cryptozoology. It's interesting. I need to maintain my relationship with books as something enjoyable as well. So when I do those, I either read a paper book or I read my Kindle and I read in my library. There's no electronics other than a Kindle allowed in that room. Actually, 2 electronics in that room. Technically, my record player is an electron and my Kindle. That's it. That's all that's allowed in that room. It's a quiet room. I sit in there, I have a comfortable chair, I relax, and I just read for pleasure. I highlight anything interesting. I don't really take notes. I'm just reading to enjoy the book and enjoy the curiosity. Then comes the third type, which is when I walk the dog in the evening. Talked about what I do in the morning or the midday when I listen to a podcast. In the evening when I walk the dog after dinner, I listen to an audiobook. And what I've started to do is listen to fiction. Because I realized I've not made enough space for fiction in my life. And fiction is generally a passive reading experience. I don't need to take notes when I'm reading fiction. So it's a perfect thing to do when I walk the dog in the evening. Right now I'm reading Owen Meany, A Prayer for Owen Meany by John Irving. It's a book that I started when I was in high school and never got to finish. So I'm finally getting back around to it. So that's the three books that I'm reading every day. And I can say focusing on those things and reducing all the other stuff, I feel so much better. I feel like I've let a little bit of it bleed back in a little bit. I've been a little bit lazy. It's been rainy and cold. So I've been kind of lazy and watching TV in the middle of the day for the last couple of days. I need to dial that back a little bit. Not a ton, but you know, what I end up doing, I'll be honest with you. What I end up doing is I end up putting on old episodes of Unsolved Mysteries and lounging. So that's what I've been allowing myself to do a little more than I should. I need that quiet time that I discovered last week to come back in. So the last thing, I think we're nearing an hour here. I'm doing all this reading. And even though I don't actively try to take notes when I'm reading the nonfiction books, I'm a nerd. I end up taking notes anyways. I typically have a journal like this laying around, or a notepad of some sort, or maybe even a field notes laying around. And I generally end up taking notes, even when I'm reading for pleasure, because I enjoy it. I enjoy it. I'm just not forcing myself to learn one specific thing. I'm just, I think Ali Abdaal refers to this as resonance. Big word for such a small thing. It means something you dig. You know, for some reason, this thing sticks out to me. Actually, it's not always something you dig. Sometimes it could be something in a book that annoys you, something that surprises you. Generally, if I highlight something and I don't make a note, it means it's self-evident why I highlighted it. Usually it's because I like the wording there, or the idea that's being said is just presented in such a way that I know that even if I read that 6 years from now, I'll understand why I highlighted it, because the idea is contained there. Everything else I will make a note on. So what I've been trying to do, and I will continue to do, with the exception of today because I'm producing a video, is I'm going to start using my social media to share those notes. I'm taking all this time to read these notes. Why shouldn't I share them with you? So it's just a way to make social media feel like I'm actually doing something with a purpose instead of what so many of us don't realize we're doing, which is using it as a self-promotion engine. Not really interested in that. I mean, I'm interested in getting people to watch the stuff I do and stuff like that, but I don't want that to be the purpose. I want that to be something that happens as a consequence of something else I'm doing. I need a purpose that happens afterwards from. And that purpose for me right now is to share the reading notes. So that's the stuff that I got from last week, sitting on that couch, totally bored. I think I drank 6 cups of tea that day, which means I peed a lot. You probably didn't need to know that. But that's it. So that's where I've been. That's what I did. That's where I am.